You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So if it's okay, I'm going to kick things off here. I'd like to start by thanking everyone who is here in the room, as well as all of those who are watching the webcast at this moment. I know all of you are busy, so try to make sure that the session today is as informative and interesting as possible. So we're here. This is the foundation for this event. Here is the publication of a paper that we just put out yesterday on looking at health governance capacity. But I thought I'd give a little bit of a foundation very, very briefly, and then my colleague Daryl West will provide quite a bit more detail. But this is in the context of a project that we launched last fall aimed at spurring and looking at the issue of private investment in global health research and development. And the premise being that as vital and important as government, public sector investment is on these issues, that it needs to be, and is in fact already, but needs to be even more so complemented by private sector investment, and that there are mechanisms that we can identify that can make the environment more conducive to increased uptick in private sector investment addressing these important challenges. So that's the broad theme for the topic. And so the way the event today is organized is my colleague Daryl West will provide an overview of some of the findings of this first report that we've put out. Then we'll move into a panel session with three absolutely terrific panelists that we're fortunate to have, and I'll introduce them when they're up here after Mr. West speaks. And then we'll have some questions. I'll ask some questions of the panel, and then we will open it up to questions both from the room as well as from people who might be watching on the webcast. So with that, I will hand it over to Daryl West, who will provide an overview of our findings so far. Thank you.
Thank you, John, and thank you for showing up. So those of you who are here have a paper copy of the report. Those of you who are watching online, you can download a copy of the report at the brookings.edu website. We also have an interactive feature on this website. You can click on each individual country and get more detailed responses for that country. So John provided the general context of this study. I want to start with two quotes that I have here on the board. Both of them come from Lancet reports. So the first one basically says, quote, neglected tropical diseases cause around 534 deaths every year, sharing a similar burden of disease to either malaria or tuberculosis. An estimated 57 million disability-adjusted life years are lost each year to neglected tropical diseases. And then the second quote is, the returns on investing in health are impressive. Reductions in mortality account for about 11% of recent economic growth in low-income and middle-income countries as measured in their national income accounts. And I want to juxtapose these two perspectives because on the one hand, they're showing that we have a great need for more investment in health R&D. And then secondly, when that investment does take place, the rate of return is very positive, both in terms of the health of the people affected, as well as the economic growth for the country as a whole. And so we wanted to undertake a project to try and take advantage of those two insights and think about ways to improve investments in global R&D. As John mentioned, this is the launch of this particular project. The paper we put out today is the first of six papers that will come out over the course of the next year. As this slide shows, there are going to be a number of different aspects of the health R&D linkage that we look at. Other papers are going to be looking at the return on investment, the spending flows and the household benefits of R&D investments. And so we want to use the research that we're undertaking to inform policymakers, investors, and thought leaders, and therefore help to drive a change in the ecosystem as a whole. So our first paper is focusing on the health governance angle, and we argue that good governance is a foundational condition for global health investments, that it affects the environment in which investment decisions take place, and we suggest that if investors are confident that their resources are actually going to reach the intended audience, that it's going to boost healthcare in those particular countries, that it's going to make people more likely to invest, that governance matters because it relates to the ability of countries to absorb new investments, there's an effect on investor perceptions, and then there's a link to the way in which the system as a whole operates, both in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. So in this particular report, we wanted to evaluate the quality of health governance. So we analyzed data from 18 individual countries. And on this slide, we list those countries. So it includes places like China, India, Indonesia, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, and Vietnam, as well as a number of other countries. We look at 25 different indicators of health governance for those particular nations. We divide the indicators into five different dimensions of health governance: management, policies, regulations, infrastructure and financing, and health systems. We argue that these are all factors based on the literature that has been undertaken, the research that other individuals have undertaken. These are the types of factors that affect investor confidence and the investment decisions that actually take place. So for each of these five dimensions, we look at several different indicators. So under health management, we're looking at things like political stability and transparency. For health policies, we look at the rule of law, the tariffs on medical products, the nature of intellectual property rights in those particular countries. For health regulations, we're looking at the regulatory capacity, the business climate, how drugs are regulated in each of those places. For infrastructure and financing, we have indicators that tap different dimensions of that. And then for health systems, we're looking at the number of nurses in particular countries, the number of physicians, some health outcome data such as infant mortality and life expectancy. And again, we're arguing that all of these are factors that condition the environment for investment decisions. And so it demonstrates how the governance of particular countries matters in terms of these types of investments. On this slide, we show some of the results in terms of how various countries fared. So for our 25 indicators, we compiled them into a 100-point scale for each country and then rated the countries on their performance. Vietnam was our most high-performing country. It scored 82 out of 100 points. South Africa had 81 points, China 77 points, Ghana 75, and so on. So as I mentioned, our full report is online. It provides much greater details on the rankings. We have an appendix to the report in which we provide the complete data that went into the analysis, and it shows how each country performed on each of those 25 indicators. Our interactive website allows you to click on individual nations to see how each one performed. We are very interested in any feedback that you have on this study, as well as suggestions for future papers that we're going to be writing. So we created a dedicated email address in which people can offer us their comments and suggestions. It's listed on the inside cover of the report, but it's healthrd@brookings.edu. So you can email any comments you have to healthrd@brookings.edu. In the conclusion of the report, we make a number of recommendations related specifically to health governance that we think would improve a country's ability to attract investment, particularly from the private sector. And so our recommendations include things such as improving transparency, strengthening the management capacity within those countries, lowering tariffs on medical products, expediting the regulatory reviews, and investing in the infrastructure. These are all things that we think would make a difference and improve the investment climate for countries going forward. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this is the first of six papers that will be coming out. So among the other things that we'll be looking at are health R&D funding levels across various sectors and how those levels have changed over time. The rate of return on particular investments, we'll be doing some modeling work that tries to develop estimates of those particular features. And then we'll also be looking at household survey data with the goal of looking at the financial benefits of global health R&D. So this is just the opening wave of the project, but by the time we have undertaken all six of these papers and put them out, we're hoping that it provides a coherent set of analysis in terms of what the current situation is and what we can do moving forward to make a difference. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to John. John will be moderating the panel. We have three distinguished experts who can offer their own perspectives on this. So with that, I will turn it over to John.
Okay, so I'm going to start by first briefly introducing our panelists. I'll then provide a little additional context over on top of what Darrell West just explained, and then go straight into some questions. So first of all, immediately to my left is Lois Pace. Ms. Pace is Global Health Council's new president and executive director. Before joining Global Health Council, she held leadership positions at the Livestrong Foundation, the American Cancer Society, and while director of regional programs for the American Cancer Society's Department of Global Health, she was responsible for developing their first capacity building and advocacy initiatives in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Next to Ms. Pace is Amanda Glassman. Ms. Glassman is Chief Operating Officer and Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development. Prior to that, she worked at the Inter-American Development Bank and also prior to that here at Brookings. She has more than 25 years of experience working on health and social protection policy and programs in Latin America and elsewhere in the developing world. And then next to Ms. Glassman is Ambassador Pham Quang Vinh, the Vietnamese ambassador to the United States. The ambassador was appointed in July 2014, and before his appointment, he held many distinguished positions within the Vietnamese government. Most recently, he was Deputy Minister of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in charge of relations with countries in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and the South Pacific, and Vietnam's senior official to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And I should also mention that the ambassador has a prior commitment at 11 o'clock, so even though our program will go past 11, that when he gets up and leaves at 11, it's not because he found our discussion uninteresting, but we're glad to get him to come here, but he had another commitment. So he'll leave at about 11 o'clock. And so as Darrell West was explaining, the premise here is that the private sector is an extremely important component of investments that can lead to improved global health outcomes. In addition to identifying the existing landscape, we're going to be also looking at ways, policies, frameworks, which can incentivize and further attract private sector investment to this area. And the theory being that while everyone agrees that there are enormous social returns that come with global health investing, in order to spur increased private sector investment, those social returns have to be accompanied by financial returns that obviously drive decisions being made in the private sector. So we're going to be looking very carefully at some of those things. I also mentioned that we're doing this project here at Brookings, but we're also fortunate to be collaborating with a terrific team of researchers at the University of Washington who will be doing some of the work associated with analyzing these really important questions. And so, as Darryl mentioned, between now and basically late next year, or actually late this year, we'll be coming out with a series of of these reports, and we certainly welcome the chance to interact with the community as those reports are published. So let me start. I will ask my first question of Ambassador Vinh on the far left, or on your right, my far left. So, Mr. Ambassador, Vietnam finished first in our rankings on the Health Governance Capacity Index. Can you tell us about how Vietnam has been so successful and what advice you might have for other countries on this topic?
I thank you very much for the studies and the reports. And I think the experiences of many countries here will be shared, and we can make a reference on how we manage healthcare in each country. For us, Vietnam, I think a number of points that we wish to share with you also that in terms of management and good delivery of healthcare services, so there's always a question of delivery services and versus capacity. So this is one of the things that management will be very much important, including legal and policy frameworks and targeted investment, and you need the workforce as well. And point number two is that we need the grassroots level services. This is very much important in Vietnam when the country is spreading not only the urban areas but also the mountainous areas. So we need the grassroots organizations and workers, including the households and the women's organizations. They are playing a very important role. And point number three, no country can work alone without the technology and the funding. Each country, especially developing countries, are having limited resources. So we need to attract investment from both international investors and private investors. And in order to do so, we need to work closely with them and how to provide a framework, available framework in terms of policy and legal regulations, also in terms of human resources. So we need to work with them. But for us, Vietnam, though we are ranking so high, but at the same time, we have a lot of challenges, including how to modernize our healthcare infrastructure, how to get more funding for both universal healthcare services and also high standard treatment. And all of this one we are discussing with potential and future investors as well. And here will be very much important. And all in all, in order to attract private investment, we need a business environment which is favorable for them to do with us as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. So my next question is for Ms. Pace. Ms. Pace, as your biography states, you have worked on the ground in more than 10 countries delivering health programs and mobilizing advocates. Based on your experience, how would you recommend that governments in developing countries create an environment that can improve health outcomes, and I'd add to that, to the extent that you have any general comments on the work that we're doing and things that we should be looking at in this area, we'd certainly welcome those as well.
No, of course. Well, first off, I think it's important to really set the stage when it comes to where we are in global health right now. There's sort of this perfect storm, I think, that's been coming for a while, and the first part of that is the burden and how the burden has shifted over time. And it's the reality is, there's this epidemiological shift that's really sort of we're all facing head on. There's also the reality that it's becoming harder to tackle some of these existing priorities. So we talk about these hard-to-reach populations in, say, HIV/AIDS, for example. And dealing with that at the same time, we're looking at issues like cancer and diabetes in these countries, even in low- and middle-income countries. So that's definitely one part of this perfect storm. I think another part is the other elephant in the room, the money, right, the financing. That's the topic of this discussion and the fact that we've been looking at flat funding the past few years and a shift in the mix of funds, the relevance of private sector funding in particular. And then finally, there's a political landscape which I think can't be ignored, not just in Washington but worldwide, and how all those things come together is very much important for private sector investment. So I know that's obvious to a lot of us in the room, but I always like to start by setting the stage and the tone for discussion and sort of how I'm coming at all of this. I was at an event the other day that said, private sector investments and public-private partnerships don't just make sense, or don't just make people feel good, they make sense. And so that's our reality. And so when I think about what countries can be doing to improve health outcomes, it's really latching on to these public-private partnerships, which I know is already happening. So I just want to acknowledge that from my experience, countries really are prioritizing public-private partnerships and these types of investments. I think countries that do well are those that really see it as strategy and not just charity. And so bringing people to the table who really understand this win-win relationship and the opportunities there. I think a lot of us are familiar with the concept of shared value as an example. I think something else that I've seen work very well is countries that really are vocal about their priorities. And so more and more we've been talking about country ownership, but really allowing countries to talk about what matters to them, what they see at their level is absolutely critical. So for example, when I was doing work in South Africa, and this is probably 10 years ago now, you have the government saying, look, we have a problem still in HIV/AIDS that we're trying to tackle, but we also have a diabetes problem here. And we need donors to pay attention to this aspect of what we're facing too. And I think that was brave of them to step out and say that at the risk of perhaps losing funding. And I think you saw other countries do well to speak up with regards to their issues and very real problems as well. I think you all hit the nail on the head with some of your recommendations in terms of improving or updating regulatory frameworks and really developing innovative financing mechanisms, strengthening health systems, obviously. So I think those recommendations are spot on as well in terms of what countries can be doing. And that obviously requires sort of a whole of government approach, not just looking at the health sector, but working with the Minister of Finance and in other areas. But I would also echo something the ambassador said about the whole of society approach too. Let's not forget the beneficiaries of health services and health technologies. Let's not forget the people on the ground, the grassroots, who can really help mobilize all stakeholders around some of these recommendations as well. In my experience, again, that has worked incredibly well for really advancing some of these recommendations. So finally, I would say I think talking more about what's working is really valuable. We can sort of present these proposals in the abstract, but obviously the case studies are absolutely critical. Global Health Council members include industry and other partners that do a very good job talking about what's working. I think the more we can sort of uplift these good examples, I know that Amanda and Center for Global Development have a lot of these as well, the better we can sort of make the case for these types of approaches. But I think I'll stop there with those comments. Really want to emphasize, though, that it's not just on governments or countries to make these changes, but it's on companies as well. To think about what they can do, and I know we'll get a little bit more into that as we get through the discussion.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Ms. Glassman, last year you published a book titled Millions Saved, New Cases of Proven Success in Global Health. In that book, you discussed health innovations occurring in the development world, in the developing world. For example, you mentioned deworming efforts in Kenya, integrated management of childhood diseases in Bangladesh, and improving childhood education in South Africa. Based on your study of these successes, how would you recommend that governments in developing countries create an environment that can improve health outcomes?
And then my, yeah, okay.
And yes,
okay,
same
so thanks,
as
thanks
with Ms. Pace, any further
for
thoughts?
For inviting me to join the panel, and it's an honor to share the panel with you, Ambassador, and Lois. So first, I think it's really a useful exercise to try and connect health system governance to domestic and private, domestic and foreign private investment in health for two reasons. One is there was the Addis Ababa Financing for Development Conference last year. They talked about billions to trillions, and the vast majority of those funds are supposed to come from the private sector. Okay, so how is that going to happen? And another good reason to think about that is because public sector funded R&D is probably on the way down, at least in the near term. So it's good to think about other options. But I think that connection needs to be spelled out a little bit further, and I had a couple of questions and comments, and then I'll end with a reference to Millions Saved. So first, I'd like to know how the governance index correlates or explains historic research and development investments. There's the GFinder project that has tracked spending on R&D in a number of contexts. So I think it wouldn't be too hard to try and look at whether governance is actually a driver, and if it's not, what parts of the index might need to be modified. Second, the title of your paper talks about a broad focus on private, either domestic or foreign investment, and I think that's appropriate. Of course, you're focused on R&D, maybe clinical trials for infectious disease-related projects. But as Lois mentioned, the biggest opportunities, especially in countries like China, like Vietnam, are in the non-communicable disease sector, where, you know, it's a pressing concern, where budgets are limited, where devices and services can be made available in the private sector at scale. So I think it's worth maybe considering a broader scope from that perspective. And then the other issue is, if we're thinking about incentivizing private investment in research and development, I think that needs to be incentivized by the public policy and coverage and reimbursement framework that operates in that country. So, for example, I trial a drug in a given health system, of course, to show efficacy and effectiveness, first of all, but also because it's a potential market or a potential payer that, if I'm successful, will actually finance that project. So you're building the market while you're doing the trial. And I think that's something to really explore very deeply. That's not going to be the case, really, in the DRCs of the world, but it will be the case in the Vietnams and the Chinas. Thinking a little bit connected to this about the indicators that make up governance success in a health system, one thing I would say is we should look at the pace of health improvement over time, not necessarily the level or in addition to the level, and not necessarily the inputs, because we know that just spending more doesn't actually improve health outcomes as quickly as it might. And unfortunately, our own country is a perfect example of that phenomenon. And let me give you two examples. So in the financing part of the index, you talk about out-of-pocket spending, and you rank it negatively, right, which we would do if we were concerned with universal health coverage. But actually, for private investment, I might like a lot of out-of-pocket spending. Those private markets are larger. Out-of-pocket spending is about spending in the private sector. So that's just something to think about. Those are obviously trade-offs that you have to make in health policy. Similarly, if I'm investing in clinical trials, I actually might not want a super strong health system initially, because I'm interested in healthcare-naive populations, right? To really be able to assess what the differential impact of my drug is or my device. So I think all of that is very interesting. I think it goes to some of the stories. For the global health-focused technologies, vaccines, drugs, and diagnostics in the area of HIV, AIDS, TB, et cetera, I think there we do have to look to the PPP models, right? I mean, MenAfriVac is one of the stories that we talk about, and I see a colleague from PATH in the audience. But that is obviously one of the stars of the PPP experience, right? It's got some private sector investment, it has the Gates Foundation, has all of the governments of the region together developing a private firm of generic manufacturing in India that come together, invest in the development of an affordable vaccine and its subsequent rollout.
Great, thanks very much. And so I've got a couple other questions, and then we'll open up the audience questions. And these questions are for anyone on the panel, so no specific preference. So one of the things that we showed is a correlation between the health governance index capacity index that we came out with and the social progress index. And there's a pretty good correlation, but the question is, correlation does not always mean causation, and you can sort of weigh which way does the arrow point. And so this is a broad question, but a fundamentally important one. What do you think about the connection between health outcomes, specifically in sort of social progress and well-being generally, and, you know, which way does the causation arrow go, or does it go both ways, and what are your thoughts on that?
When we do the universal healthcare coverage, and the first thing we need to do is not just the treatment, but it's the raising the awareness in the local community. And with all this one, the household is very much important, and the grassroots workers very much important. And by that doing, we're raising the education level of each of the households in the localities. And by that, they themselves can take care of the diseases. But at the same time, we have the outbreak of pandemics. This is the time that we need to work both from the central to central governments to the local government and the people in the community. And I think when we have a grassroots level in good place, then the management from the central government to the local government will be very much effective, rather than we will be in a panic in case of that one. So for social progress in relations to healthcare, it's more than just the treatment itself. It's the education, it's the acknowledgement and awareness of the people, but at the same time, they are taking care of their healthcare rights, health rights as well. And I think it goes for each household in the management of both their welfare and their budget as well.
Thank you. Any thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean, for me, if I'm interpreting it correctly, it was actually one of the least surprising findings of the report. I think when we, you know, look at the Sustainable Development Goals and the linkages we've been trying to create there as a community, it's absolutely about this. And so even just using, say, the gender lens as an example, improving access to education or health services is intended to drive human development of that population. And we've seen that in the data. We've seen that anecdotally of people working in the field. And so I don't know if I would venture to say which one leads to the other. I might leave that to Amanda.
I mean, you have some of the same indicators in as the Social Progress Index, so I'm not surprised to see it either. And I guess that's the question. I wonder if you could look at some of your individual indicators to try and tease out whether particular policy approaches are making some kind of a difference on some of the outcomes.
Interesting. Okay. So my next question is, so what we, as Darrell West mentioned, when you're trying to assess health governance capacity, how do you actually measure that, right? And obviously, you know, any one particular approach you select is subject to reasonable criticisms, but if you use that as a reason not to select any approach, then you end up never measuring it. So the approach that we selected, which we think is reasonable, although certainly not the only way or necessarily even the best way to do it, is to consider it as having these five dimensions or components, or however you want to call them. And I'll remind people again, the five dimensions were management capacity, policies, regulations, infrastructure, and financing. And we just assumed they were equally important, all of them. And that's, you know, it's a debatable assumption. And so the question, you know, for the panel is, of these things, again, you know, the management capacity, the policies, the regulations, the infrastructure, and the financing, are there ones of those that you believe are disproportionately impactful and important in terms of the health outcomes in the country? And we'd love to hear your thoughts on sort of what the, you know, if any of those stand out, basically. Or on the other hand, any of those are particularly unimportant. That would be interesting to hear your thoughts as well.
I have this bias, though, that health governance, that we know health governance is working if health is improving, although that's not necessarily the case from a causal standpoint, right? So if I'm seeing life expectancy and infant mortality rate and the population at risk of malaria, if those things are improving over time, that to me denotes something's working in the health system governance, although it's not necessarily the case. Could be completely explained by secular trends, but you could, you know, tease that out a little bit. I guess I'm also, obviously the amount of spending matters at some level. Generally speaking, countries that spend more do better, although once you get up over a certain amount, there's no
saturation point.
Clear relationship, and there's definitely variability in performance. So I think, you know, those things are critical. And then doing the right cost-effective things, right? So if you're immunizing your kids, if you're, you know, you've mentioned some of those things. Yeah, I mean, I would almost deal with regulatory policy issues very separately from the other stuff and analyze them separately, just because that is the lesser known set of variables.
Okay.
I do agree with your comments, and especially on the cost and effective. I think the idea of how to use the best of limited resources, especially is funding. So the recommendation in the report about targeted investment and investment properly, that would be very much important. But in all these things for in taking care of the health of the people, the role of the government will be the first one, both in providing an environment of legal and policy frameworks, but at the same time in our case, the coordination between the central government and the local government will be very much important. Sometimes you have a good policy frameworks, but coordination is not true, then this is a point of management that we need to focus on as well.
Well, I have to say I was drawn to this health systems dimension as something that I thought would be a driver. I was kind of surprised at how narrowly that had been defined because I'm so used to the WHO framework and the six building blocks there. And that's convenient because it captures some of the other indices I think you all were looking at, like leadership and financing. So I was drawn to it, and I do think that from our standpoint, is a good driver and a good indicator, but you know, I'd be open to discussing
maybe
that.
The other thing you might look at is like the number of universities that have programs in related areas, the number of PhDs, the presence of an industrial policy, which could go either way. That's a controversial issue in the field. How much existing market access is there for multinationals? So these are things I think that are actually more closely linked to the probability of R&D investment in general. But then again, that's why I think it's really different to talk about R&D in general, and it could still be health promoting, as in the NCD example, versus global health R&D for diseases of the poor. That's a really different kind of business case for private sector investment, and it's not a very attractive one. So that's why we have all the PPPs, right?
Right. And then another challenge, which you're sort of all getting at, is you know, when we're constructing these five dimensions and then 25 indicators across these things, there's obviously some cross correlations, you know, among these things. And so, on the one hand, you want to have a broad set of indicators. On the other hand, if some of your indicators are really measuring sort of the same thing, is it really a separate indicator? And so, that's just an inherent challenge in some of these things. So, I've got one more question, and then we'll open it up to audience questions. So, today's report was published as part of a broader project, which I mentioned earlier, to identify ways to spur improved private sector opportunities and investment in global health R&D. And there's obviously multiple ways to do that. For example, one thing is to identify new opportunities for companies to invest in developing drugs, vaccines, and diagnostics that will improve global health and also obviously make sense from a business perspective. Another complementary approach is for the government in countries such as the United States to introduce policy solutions. And for example, priority review vouchers are an example, and you can debate how effective or not effective those are, but they are certainly examples of policy solutions that are intended to incentivize to boost private sector investment in areas that otherwise wouldn't be as much as high. Do any of you have thoughts on ways to spur increased private sector investment? What can governments and/or the private sector, and the private sector, not only traditional profit-seeking companies, but charitable foundations and venture capital, private equity community. What can people outside the government do, or even inside the government do, but to in a way to increase the attractiveness of the private sector that the private sector sees in this very important space? Any thoughts on that?
I would say first and foremost is creating the space, right? So there's been this ongoing debate at the global level with WHO around the framework for the engagement of non-state actors. And that's been a bit contentious because of how that's been defined, how non-state actors have been defined, and then how it seems certain countries are wanting to interpret that quasi-guidance. And the issue I think a lot of civil society has with that is related to how they can be left out of the planning process or the execution or delivery of healthcare services or the development of technologies and diagnostics and whatnot. So I think just at a very high level, engaging in things like that seem very wonky, but I think it gets at that policy space you were talking about is really important because if some of these actors are left out, and I'm not just talking about industry, I am talking about some of these other private sector players who have found it challenging to work directly with governments because of some of these discussions, if they're left out of the conversation, then there's not much more they feel that they can do. And if it's just a matter of them sort of writing a check and not really engaging in the process, I think that we sort of all lose if we're a bit too limiting. To be clear, managing conflict of interest is incredibly important, and ensuring that everyone's sort of behaving well in the space is really important. I think that applies to all the actors. I think that applies to governments and industry and NGOs and a number of players. And so I think these types of conversations like FENSA are critical, but we have to be able to see all sides of it and really look at the unintended consequences of having too stringent a policy when it comes to the engagement of the private sector.
I think I'll just go back to a point that I made earlier. I think if there's not a government payer or a private insurance payer or a global health payer that doesn't say, I will reimburse and cover if you bring me a product of the following characteristics, then it doesn't really crowd in private sector funding on its own. It requires all of this kind of organization from the bottom up. So I think that's what I mean by creating kind of a payment framework where you determine what is that cost-effective technology that I will for sure reimburse if it comes to market. That would create its own thing. But the other thing is, you know, obviously there's other ways to spur greater private sector participation in health systems. It's controversial, but you know, there's health systems that look like Colombia and the Netherlands, where there are private insurers that take public monies, but those private insurers have a role. They compete with each other. There's social marketing firms where the public subsidy is, you know, 5% DKT, and 95% is what they're making in selling of family planning products. Can a public sector buy from the private sector, either because hospitals are privatized or certain services within hospitals are privatized and I buy them? Under what circumstances am I getting good business? Am I getting good value for money? Faith, you know, obviously, can I buy from a faith-based hospital? A lot of health systems in Africa will do that to cover a certain package of care. So I think it's all about sort of building that the incentives in the system that can allow for private sector participation, but in a pro-social way. Right, you don't want it going out of control, so you have, you know, a million MRI scans or whatever it is, right?
Any thoughts?
Actually, we do need the private investors in this one, and they will play an important role in healthcare and also in R&D. But at the same time, I do agree with you that we need to engage between government officials and private investors. We need to understand the priorities and incentives of each, because the government has to take care in a broader and universal way of the health of the people. So we need to understand the priorities. And I remember one of the panelists here just say that the country's priorities will be very much important. So we need to share with them. By that sharing the understanding of the priorities of each private investors and the government responsibilities, then we can have matching of pairings of priorities that we are in common. Then the second point, I agree with you that by that we would need a framework that we can work together, and at the same time we can have a different manners of attracting investment. So a mixed framework will also be very much important.
Great, thank you very much. Really, really terrific perspective. So at this point, we are happy to take questions from the audience. I think there's a protocol. Someone does have a microphone somewhere. We have somebody standing with a microphone. So if anyone would like to ask a question, if you could, we've got a gentleman up here and the woman here. So maybe he had his hand up first and then her next. So number one and number two, and then we'll take it from there. And then, okay, I've got one or three.
Good morning. My name is Todd Wiggins. The question is specific about Vietnam. It seems as though the image of Vietnam as a manufacturing center has certainly developed since the war. So could you talk a little bit about that? I'm seeing more and more made in Vietnam stickers and tags on clothing and other items. So what's the potential of that market?
I'm sorry, is there a connection to the topic of... Just sort of context, are you asking about manufacturing in general or in the context of health?
I think it has global context in general. I think that you could probably address that as the pertinence.
Actually, for us, the economy of Vietnam over the past three decades has been fundamentally transformed. We have been doing the reforms for the last decades, especially in terms of the economy. We move on some other models to the market-based model. And this is the way that we extend the economy that we work along the market rules and regulations. And so, as a developing country, sometimes you first win more on labor-extensive industries. It's not only just manufacturing, but also in our region, country, and in others. So with regard to manufacturing, there are two points here. Point number one, we have a large workforce of the people, the young people. But point number two, we need the technologies from more developed countries. So very much often, our manufacturing is a joint venture between Vietnam and foreign investors. So by that, we increase more our development, economic development as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Number second question here.
Thanks very much. I'm Nomo Ndenolu Chungu. I'm health attaché at the Embassy of South Africa. I'm thrilled to see South Africa being second only to Vietnam, Excellency, in this report. We're encouraged by that. My comment is, I do understand that governments will represent their populations in terms of priorities, as all of the panelists are saying. But I think there is another piece at focal, local community level where you implore or apply what's called the base of the pyramid approach, engaging communities about defining their problems. The governments will define the priorities and the problems. But I think that the subjects of the R&D will be the members of the communities themselves. I think partnerships at local level with those communities would be key, so that whoever it is that is leading projects or R&D will work in partnership with communities guided by the regulatory frameworks and the supports of governments. I think that's a piece that perhaps can be strengthened in the report. I was wondering also on the issue of autonomy of the private sector, how you navigate that question as it pertains to economic ideological perspectives, where the private sector, for instance, will insist that we cannot be told by governments to do A, B, C, and D. At the same time, too, the governments will say, we are the government, we are the state, and these are the priorities, and we think that R&D money should go in this direction. How would this kind of work actually assist, navigate those differences? I'm saying that this report is important, and I'm hoping that it won't be gathering dust in shelves. I think that it should be taken. It should be taken yet another level to go there to educate all of the players, including people at local level, about just understanding how these things work. So those are comments and a little bit of question about how to navigate the economic ideological differences between the private and the public sector. We number two in governance. Thank you.
Thank you. Thoughts from the panel?
Well, I can definitely appreciate the comments about getting to the local level and grassroots engagement, civil society participation, however we want to word it, how you said it is better than I think any of us would have put it. And so, yes, to all of that. I think relatedly, ensuring that there are sets of principles or rules of engagement is the way that I would approach that. Your question around how we can ensure everyone's sort of operating from the same manual, I think, is what you're getting at. And being very clear about what motivates you and why you're at the table. Look, let's be honest. We are not all going to be driven by the same things across sectors, right? But as long as we can acknowledge, I think, where we converge and diverge, then we can focus on that common ground and work accordingly. So having clear sets of principles, I think that's something else I would add to what countries can bring to the table, and frankly, I guess what industry can too. But if there is another directive to be added for governments, is to really be clear about those rules of engagement and to put a stake in the ground. I think that there's nothing wrong with that, and it's absolutely essential.
to say the same thing again, but that is that. Because will the South African government pay for it as part of its health system? Will that technology be included in the essential benefits plan that is articulated by the medical schemes in South Africa? That is the best way to ensure private sector crowding in for the priorities that the government has. So I think, and that's what we, unfortunately, I think that we have not set out clear guidelines on what we will cover or reimburse, whether at the global health level or not. I think you see a kind of ad hoc policy. I think you want to ask for cost effectiveness. I think you want to ask, obviously, for affordability, and you want to ask for something that's going to be a game changer, ideally. So these are wish lists, but you know there are lots of companies out there that if they cross that line and they know that they'll be paid for it in a certain volume, things will happen.
I think that the focus on the local communities would be very much important. I do totally agree with you on that one. And on managing the different interests between the private investors and the government and local communities, one of the things that we do in Vietnam is that we do not have across the board for private funding and investment yet. So we're taking care of the people's health. Then we need to do some pilot projects. And through that we develop an understanding of sharing the priorities and interests. And by that, the government can provide some incentives to the private sectors. So we will multiply those pilots to become more and more nationwide frameworks.
Thank you very much. I had a question in the... You can raise your hand so he knows. Yeah. Anyone else has questions? You can. Okay, I've got one up here.
Hi, my name is Solzhen, and I'm a consultant with the World Bank. Fascinating discussion. I wanted to ask a question. So, you know, you talked about epidemiological shift happening, but at the same time, there are certain diseases that may be more profitable for, you know, the private sector to be involved in, but there are other diseases, the neglected tropical diseases, for example. How can governments incentivize private sector to invest more in R&D for those diseases? So that's my question one. And I would also love to know the panel's thoughts on recent CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Thank you.
Thoughts?
Amanda's a broken record.
Well, I mean, I'll just talk about something new. I mean, there are, I think, a lot of people in the sector, from Bio to the Global Health Technologies Coalition to PATH, have been talking about, you know, not just the routine process of saying what I will pay for every year if I'm a payer or reimburser, but also special schemes like prizes and advanced market commitments and things like that. So volume guarantees, the way implants were bought by a coalition that worked on maternal and child health supplies. So there's lots of thinking about new and innovative ways that governments, including the government of Vietnam, for example, could set up a pull mechanism for, I don't know, you name the disease priority that you might have, you know, if that were of interest, and, you know, you could give preference to partnerships with local researchers and things like that, clinical trials that were conducted in country. So, I mean, maybe we'll see more of that going ahead. I mean, if you look at a country like Brazil, they set up their own research institutes, right? There's Fiocruz and Instituto Butantan. Those are things that the bank can invest in, right, which is to develop that R&D capacity in the public sector. Or you can crowd in the private sector. So all of those things are out there.
Actually, for developing countries, the R&D in the prevention sector will be very much important. The vaccines and all the other kind of medicines that is to prevent diseases for the people or curable diseases. So that's why we have R&D centers in our own country, but at the same time, it depends on the different private investors. Maybe the know-how, maybe the technology infrastructure, and maybe co-production. And all this one we can do, it depends on the different areas of medical priorities. It depends on the different private sectors and investors. So we work in a very flexible way so that it can meet the priorities of the government, but also have incentives for the private investors. But developing countries focus more in R&D on prevention. Higher standards of medicines and treatment, I think, in a more developed countries, and we need the license.
Thank you.
And co-production could be good also.
Yeah, the medicines patent pool. I forgot to mention.
Okay. On top of that, you know, some of these newer partnerships too that have emerged in global health security or even Access Accelerated announced at WEF this year. I think those are encouraging partnerships to see, really encouraging developments. One thing I would say though is, you know, in talking with some industry partners, I think we need to be careful asking them to carry all of the water, especially now that things are shifting. And I think if I were working in that sector, I'd be a little bit concerned about sort of everything falling onto my sector now in terms of, you know, really stepping up to the plate. I think it is good that they have been, you know, stepping up even more. I think you have companies collaborating in a way they haven't previously, which is also exciting because a lot of times that, for those of us who've worked at this for a while, you know, they keep their powder dry. To see them come together is useful and productive. This still, though, needs to be a multi-sector partnership. And so we still need to have a role for government and for other actors in that space. And so I think that's something we all need to keep in mind and push for. It needs to be sort of a three-legged stool in my mind.
And did you want to mention patent pools? You said
Just that there are these other ways to license technology to developing countries themselves to do their own manufacturing that are interesting and probably should be explored further, right?
Yeah,
that's a way
true.
To do price discrimination,
so dynamic,
to segment the market. Maybe a little add that we are actually thinking about the future of global health procurement at the Center for Global Development and hope to do more work in this space as well. So we'll think about that too.
Great. Thank you very much. And the gentleman with the mic.
Thank you. My name is Stephen. I'm retired from medical practice and just a casual participant in this forum here. What I'm hearing is that we're trying to get financing, we're trying to get private sector participation, get government participation. We want to affect health outcomes. I'm going to try to formulate this as a question. Can we develop, or is there a program developed where we can motivate all these players to interact together? For example, private sector company has a lot of money. They want to improve the outcome and the health care of the local people, which is what ultimately we all want. Incentivize those people to participate in a program, for example, diabetes. They show up at the clinic, get educated, they take their medicine, they get points. These points then go towards something they want, either satisfaction of knowing that they are participating, or maybe some money's donated to a charity, or maybe they're going to get a prize when they build up enough points. Develop a program. Is there something like this that ties everybody together? And if not, could we develop
something? You're asking about incentivizing participation by people.
Well as the industry. Okay. A private company has money they want spent, and maybe they want less diabetes, or maybe they want more of their diabetes products used, or maybe condoms in countries HIV problem. Is that a practical idea? Is it?
Yeah, and I think it's happening. I mean, I'm looking to reps from Global Health Technologies Coalition and PATH, as Amanda mentioned, who are here, and I know who had their hands raised. I feel like that type of example is taking place on the ground right now, and there are case studies that I think we can share following this to the extent that's useful for this audience. Because again, uplifting those would be very helpful, learning from what's worked, what hasn't, and maybe that can be a part of follow-up briefs that will look more closely at those investments and the return on those investments could be useful. So I'm hoping that.
In fact, one of our papers will be looking specifically at returns on investments in these things. So that's a great area to look at. Any other thoughts from? Okay, I think we have. I've got a question here, and I've got you next.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this panel, and I really look forward to digging into these reports and the future reports as well. My name is Claire Wingfield. I'm with PATH, which has been mentioned a few times. Thanks. Just a few thoughts and then a broader question. One, I think in line with Dr. Nwelosungu's comment about sort of the differing ideologies, I think it's also the differing timelines of private sector. Political timelines and research timelines are also a real challenge to balance. But I also wanted to just make a second comment that in the healthcare infrastructure, I hope we're also thinking about the research and with an eye towards product development infrastructure as well. So that includes manufacturing, but not just basic research within countries, but also translating that basic research into products that are addressing the priority health needs for that country. But my last question, my actual question is, you know, Amanda mentioned Fiocruz. I think of another great example in South Africa, the SHIP program, the partnership between the Department of Science and Technology and the MRC is also a great example of trying to really provide a platform for public-private partnership and academia as well, which I think is an important role. So I'm just wondering, Amanda, if you might be able to talk a little bit more about what were the elements that kind of work in those examples? What needed to happen to actually get something like that off the ground? Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, I think it's a great question. I mean, actually sitting in front of you as an actual Brazilian person who might be able to mention. I'm not an expert in this area, but I think it's actually a perfect role for development banks or for governments themselves that want to invest in science and technology policy, right? So it's, and I think partially they were driven by political moments. Those countries were, in a way, cut off from the rest of the global economy for a period of time. Partially is that they had a lot of PhDs that went back to their country and started up work there with a social commitment. And part of it is the willingness of public policymakers to invest. So I do think that there's probably a role for the banks from a external position. I don't know how well they've actually done at investing in these kinds of science and technology programs. My perception is that it's a little bit patchy, and they haven't necessarily connected it to the way it, as a way to crowd in private sector investment, as you say. That could be interesting.
Thank you very much. I think we had a question here. Any other questions? If you raise your hand.
Yes, hi. My name is Jessica. I'm an intern at the Congress of Neurological Surgeons. So if we have these R&D companies invest in these third world countries, do you think that they're going to be able to keep up with innovative payment models that are reflecting the science that's developing these drugs?
I think so. Well, innovative payment model. So... Well, a couple of things. To run a clinical trial in a low- and middle-income country is many times less expensive and potentially less complicated from a procedural standpoint than if you have to run something in the U.S. And there's been a little bit of work sort of comparing the costs and benefits, so that's why I think a lot of companies are interested in doing clinical trial research in low- and middle-income countries, obviously with all of the safeguards that are necessary for working in those kinds of settings. The payment model, if I'm thinking about whether South Africa is going to reimburse, the latest cutting-edge drugs, that could potentially be trialed in South Africa, that's difficult because they have a budget constraint that's so very different from a market like the United States or a market like Japan. So... these are the difficulties. And one of the other things that we see is that
Once medication, a new device is available in a country, maybe you trialed it in that country, the pressure to reimburse is there already because some people have it and some people would like to have it, and it might be reimbursed by the private sector or private insurers, and then the public sector wants it too, which could be good in the near term because I feel like the public sector has to increase spending. No matter what your perspective, I think we all agree that public spending on health is extremely low and needs to increase in most middle-income countries especially. So maybe that's a healthy pressure, but it also can mean trade-offs in the near term with cost-effective interventions. Yeah.
Any further questions from any?
Hi, my name's Amit Mistry. I work at the National Institutes of Health, and I was just curious if you could talk a bit about the differences in incentivizing multinational corporations versus working with local private sector, or maybe strengthening local private sector in some cases.
I don't know if I have a good answer for that, but it was a question that I had as well, and that we talked about a little bit even in the green room beforehand. You know, how broad really is private sector in this context, and you know, are we really looking at the social impact or the social entrepreneurs or the impact investors, or you know, who really needs to be incentivized? And you really need to have different, I think our conclusion was you need different incentives for those different actors, obviously. I think for multinationals, they are going to be generally concerned with some of the regulatory issues and kind of those high level policy, I'll call them barriers, that they find when they go into country. I think in terms of other groups that are looking at product development, for example, I would argue that they are more concerned with kind of that local level engagement that we were talking about. And there's much more of an interest of some of those players in getting to the end user and accessing those stakeholders, which can also be somewhat challenging in those settings. And so that's how I view it. And it's probably obvious, but it's like, you know, you have these big players really being concerned at the high level, maybe more global issues, and then you have some of the other actors really looking at this problem from the ground up. And there's just issues on either side that need to be addressed.
I guess I'd add, if I can answer one of the questions.
Yes, please.
I'd add to that. I think from the multinational perspective, I think there's some interesting leverages because you are a multinational and you're looking at multiple markets. So, for example, suppose country X institutes some incentive that viewed alone in that context is not sufficient to actually create enough incentive to actually do something. If country X does that and country Y, you know, does a related incentive, and the multinational is able to kind of get the combined benefit in some way of these incentives, they're in a much better position than an entity that's only working in one country to sort of leverage those kind of correlations across incentives in different jurisdictions. So I think, you know, I think one of the, there's, you know, then you can ask the question, you know, should you wait? So there's clearly a potential benefit. Then the question, should you just wait for it to happen by luck and hope it happens and hope people are efficient at identifying it? Or does it make sense for some countries, you know, if a country is saying, I could do this incentive or that incentive, and everything, all else being equal, they say, well, if I do this incentive, that's going to actually align with the incentive that this other country is doing, and that's going to maybe spur. So in other words, these countries can make decisions in a non-independent manner, obviously still keeping, first and foremost, the primacy of their own goals of health in their own countries. But, you know, when you have these all else being equal type situations, that can factor as well. So multinationals have that advantage. On the flip side, they obviously are less likely to have the deep, you know, knowledge specific to a particular jurisdiction that a more local player would have, and that can make potentially give you a disadvantage in terms of fully capitalizing on an incentive structure that might be in place. So advantages on both sides, but it's a terrific question.
The regional approach, though, is an important one. I'm glad you raised it, because we've seen that worked with pooling and procurement, right? Mm-hmm. And so just keeping in mind, and it's too bad the ambassador had to leave, but there are other country representatives here who can speak to that, to the benefits of that as well.
We've got a question back here.
Hi, I'm Beth Yell. I haven't quite figured out how to phrase my question, so bear with me. When we refer to institutional capacity of each of these governments to either regulate or manage these investments, and also serve as an incentive for this, you know, for the companies and also other public sector or bilateral investments in these countries, But the nitty-gritty of capacity is whether government has HR manuals, whether they can have the spokes of capacity of do they have documentation, registration, and a lot of the investment in building the capacity of these governments has been from public sector, either multilateral, bilateral. How much, in your opinion, should or will private sector invest in that nitty-gritty of building the capacity of these governments to create the enable environment and so on that we speak about that's so important in leading to this?
I don't think they will at all. I think that's the responsibility of the public sector. And I really like the, well, there are some issues with it, but like the doing business index, I actually think maybe you should do like a doing business and health index instead, because it's down to that, right? I mean, how easy is it to even, and in what, if you asked about domestic private sector in R&D, that's a pretty small group of organizations and people, and I would guess that many of them are kind of not-for-profit, semi-autonomous, with a lot of public funding. So that's, I think, something that we need to explore further. But it's the, I guess it's the job of each government, but also, you know, you can imagine that the World Bank or the IFC or other kinds of organizations would try and build that business climate that would make sense for government.
I do think that we've seen companies come into countries, though, and focus on technical assistance when it comes to some of the recommendations that you guys have made. So I agree, like, they're not going to be writing those HR manuals necessarily, but and maybe it's because of I've worked in the NCD context, but I've seen that happen. I've seen companies come in and say, okay, you know what, we can't sort of, there's no market for us here yet, but what can we do to create the space for one? Mm-hmm. And recognizing that they've worked with professional societies and, you know, other players in the space to try and get at some of those capacity building issues. So I wouldn't want to sort of leave with the impression that that's not happening at all. But agree, I think it's a joint approach.
The issue is that companies have a kind of conflict of interest, right? Because they're trying to grow the market and sell a product at the same time, which is totally fine. And like, there are all kinds of access schemes that are really, really interesting. But I think as a government, you have to also, you know, structure that in a way that's going to make
work
sense
for you.
Yeah. Exactly. But I, you know, the other thing is, you know, the people trying to do business, their experiences are what matters, right? So the Doing Business Index does a survey of firms to ask them, well, what, you know, how long did it take you to do this? What happened? What was your experience? And that's the kind of thing that I think could really add value. Like, what are the bureaucratic problems that firms are facing, whether they're domestic or international, in terms of trying to set something up and move ahead?
Thank you very much. Got a question in the back?
Hi, happy Global Health Day. I'm a student from Johns Hopkins sites just across the street. My name is Yu Qian. So not long ago, Senator Cruz and Lee introduced a bill trying to bring in international reciprocal agreements for drug approval, trying to use that to bring down prices, drug prices in the U.S. market. My question is, to what extent do you think that will help spur the private investment in R&D, and how feasible would that be for developing countries? Thank you.
I don't want to answer that question. Okay. Well, let me actually give you another example. So there is a project to harmonize regulatory processes in the southern part of Africa, basically led by South Africa and some others, but it's around the idea that not every regulatory agency has to review every drug, especially generics, right? So, you know, one agency can do the job and all the rest of those countries can also grant market access for those drugs. And I think that is actually a very sensible way to go. I think the U.S. situation is quite special. It's hard to extrapolate from that to elsewhere, but maybe that's a good time to turn it over to you to answer.
The hardest part of the question. I think you kind of got at the motivation of that legislation, which is really more about the U.S. market and patient population more than it is about people in low and middle income countries, I would argue. We have mechanisms to try to drive down those prices. You look at the Gavi model as an example and some of the others that we've mentioned already. So it's a bit difficult, I think, for both of us to connect that particular example to what we're talking about today, just because I think they are more concerned with this argument that people in other countries, including, you know, in Western Europe, are paying less than U.S. citizens. So how can we ensure that, you know, we receive the same discounts? That's, I think, a different, or maybe even outside the scope of this discussion of how we can ensure there's adequate investment, but also access, affordability, availability in other countries to vaccines, diagnostics, and therapeutics.
Yeah, other countries generally don't have the requirement to buy nationally. Some do, especially countries that have industrial policy, like Indonesia, for example. They have domestic manufacturers, so there's that. China as well.
So. Well, and you know, when you have, well, never mind. I won't say anything about universal
long
health coverage.
Discussion.
Okay, any final questions? Okay, well, I want to thank all of those in the room and all of those online for taking some time. So, and thanks absolutely to our terrific panelists.